You are listening to a dramatic monologue by Genevieve Bass, recorded on Sunday, March 6, 2016, at the Poincaré Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I sent a letter. I did. I wanted to think that I didn't have to, that he would just know. But I did it anyways. And he never came. What was I supposed to think? That he had purposely abandoned us? That he had more important matters to handle? Or that he simply wished to ignore it? Never occurred to me that perhaps he wasn't meant to be there on time. At that time, however, I was in no state to consider this, as I was trapped in my own set of affairs, one which required all my energy and emotions. And I just couldn't comprehend why he had been there for others, but not for us. In such a dire circumstance, to leave us stranded, without any sense of hope, praying for something miraculous to happen. But all we found was grief. Disappointment. And a tomb. He had failed our expectations. Now, you may call me bitter, that's fine. Or say to me, Martha, you're overreacting. Everything happens for a reason. But bear with me for a few moments while I explain to you exactly what happened. And perhaps then you'll understand why I speak the way I do. It was the month of Adar, and the winter season was coming to its close. The rains had begun to fall on the dry earth, wetting its brown roots and giving us expectations for a fresh spring full of new growth. But inside, within our home, we were only witnessing the opposite. Our brother Lazarus had grown horribly ill, and everything happened so fast we hardly had time to send a letter at all. I had never seen anyone deteriorate so quickly. To go from seemingly perfect health to utter weakness. Hardly moving. Hardly breathing. We sent word immediately once we realized that he was not improving. Lord, we wrote, he whom you love is ill. We thought that that would be enough, that there was no need to explain details or beg for his arrival. This was the teacher's beloved. A man of dear relation. Why wouldn't he come? However, we had heard that months before, while in Jerusalem for the Feast of Dedication, he had been speaking to the people about his works and how they were done in the Father's name to bear witness about him. But he had claimed that he and the Father were one, which was, of course, blasphemy according to the Jewish leaders. We couldn't understand it either. Why would he say that? They had actually picked up stones to finish him off. But somehow he escaped and withdrew with his disciples somewhere across the Jordan. So he was a fair distance from us, at least a full day's journey. But if he left as soon as he received the letter, then surely he would arrive in time. But as time slipped between our fingers, so did the life of our brother, who breathed his last just as the festival of Purim was about to begin. All of Judea was preparing to celebrate the victory of Queen Esther in the days of the Persian Empire, when she'd helped to defeat a plot to kill all the Jews. The town was dressing in colorful costumes, acknowledging Yahweh's faithfulness, and making joyous music. And then there we were, invading their merriment, forcing them to forsake their jubilee and be with us in our solemn grief instead. It was a Jew's obligation to visit with and console the bereaved. And since Lazarus was well known among the people of Bethany, it wasn't long before the mourners were at our doorstep. The leaders of Jerusalem were trying to arrest him. So maybe that's why he didn't come. Because he was afraid of his own death. I suppose a piece of this bitterness may be due to pride as well. I had told the others not to worry, not to expect a time of mourning, because I knew the teacher would come to heal him. He had done so for so many others, it was only natural for me to expect the same would happen here. Why wouldn't he? He had dwelt with us, in our home, eaten with us, laughed with us, cared for us, called us friends. But he never came. The air was humid at that time of year, so we had to wrap the body quickly and only use a few of our spices and fragrances. We only had a few, and when we finished, one yet remained on the table, the one in the alabaster jar that Lazarus himself had brought back from India. It was Mary's favorite. She wished to hold on to it as a keepsake. Our brother was no small man. He was strong from working so many seasons in the field, so it took many strips of linen to cover his limp body. It had to be tight, keeping the arms and legs straight. And every inch covered was another tear staining the material, as we prepared to see each piece of him for the last time. The head was last. And there are no words for this experience. For the most part, you feel as lifeless as the body you're wrapping. The men of Bethany carried the body to the hillside, and we watched as they placed it on the floor of the tomb and rolled the stone in front. Mary and I just stood there, she sobbing, myself unable to comprehend all that had just occurred. It's a strange experience. Grief. As if your thoughts hover over you, unable to connect with your emotions that are chaotic within you. All I could think about actually was how we would need to come back the following year to collect the bones. When we returned to the house, we were greeted by the neighbors who had brought over a meal. And then we entered into our period of grieving, sitting on the floor and allowing friends and family to visit and help in the releasing process. And yet all that filled my mind was, why hadn't he come? Why had death been victorious? It had been a few days since the burial, and we were still receiving visitors, those who had traveled from a distance. But not once had I seen Mary lead the house. She had always been the more emotional. When we were younger, she had been the one admiring the beauty of the birds, awed by how the wind beneath their wings kept them afloat. I, on the other hand, had been keeping track of the hour, knowing that when the sun was hitting the mountain at just the right spot, that it was time to go home. She had been the one to throw items in the basket as we walked through the market, while I counted them to make sure we didn't buy more than enough. She had been the one to sit at the teacher's feet. While I had worried about propriety and mouths being filled, she had been the one to sit with our brother in his last moments, taking in all she could. While I had stood anxiously by the window, assuming that at any moment our help would arrive. So, when it had been 4 days since the burial, and we suddenly found out that the teacher had arrived and was entering the village with his disciples, it only made sense that I was the one who rushed out to meet him while Mary stayed inside. Overcome with emotion, she couldn't face him, couldn't allow herself to be seen in such a state of grief. I wanted an answer. I found my pace quickening as I strode down the walkway, gaining speed as I saw the crowds gathering around him just outside of the village. I began pushing through the people, forcing my way to the front, and with every effort, I lost a piece of my senses and emotions took over. Pain, rejection, pride, anger, frustration, guilt, hurt. It all pushed me to the center of the mob, and when I finally reached him, my entire being just fell at his feet, and I cried out in front of everyone, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." The crowd went silent, and everyone's eyes were now fixated on the teacher, waiting to hear his excuse for the delayed arrival. At first, he didn't speak at all. He simply scanned the crowd, looking into each pair of eyes, all of which were directed at him. Some accusing, some doubting, many wondering why he had bothered to come at all. There was a strange appearance about him, an odd sort of feeling, as if he was searching for something. I felt convicted and realized I hadn't offered him any understanding. Perhaps he hadn't known or had been delayed for a reason. Well, he could still offer us comfort, still take this burden of grief from us. So I added, "But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." But then he looked down at me with my head bowed before him and said, "Your brother will rise again." That was it. That was all he could offer, a reminder that the dead would be resurrected. I was so tired of this stale sort of comfort that was only leaving me bitter and empty. We all knew that the dead would be resurrected on the last day. It was a standard teaching. Many had already mentioned that to me. So I bitterly responded, "I know that my brother will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. I knew that that was yet to come, but what about here? What about now?" I felt a tear fall down my cheek. It slipped off my chin and fell on the dusty ground in front of me, wetting the dry earth like the rains in early spring. But then he said, "I am the resurrection and the life. I looked up at him, and just at that moment, a ray of light peeked through the clouds for the first time in weeks, and it shone behind him so brightly that his face blended into it. I had to squint so much I could only see an outline of him, but I could hear him as he shouted out over top of the crowd, "Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die." His eyes met mine and he asked me, Do you believe this? Do you believe this? I didn't know how to respond. I knew what I should have said, but the way he asked me made me feel as if I really didn't know. Who did I believe him to be? I knew that he was the anointed one, the chosen one, sent to lead God's people as David had, to be a son of God, to lead and save Israel. So I said, well yes, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, he who is coming into the world. And yet something within me made me feel as if I still didn't understand. He told me to go and call my sister. So I ran back to the house. And as I walked in the doorway, it was as if there was a dark fog of grief hovering over the sea of black figures seated on the ground. Mary was in the corner, so I weaved through the others to whisper that the teacher was here and was calling for her. Immediately, she arose to come back with me, and those who were in the house began to follow, most likely assuming that we were going to the hillside to mourn by the tomb. As soon as Mary saw the teacher, she tried to run to him, but her legs were so weak from kneeling, she stumbled and had to lean on me for support. But as soon as we were close enough, she too fell at his feet and cried out, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." It was the first time, I think, that we had ever done anything alike. But this time, when he looked down at Mary, weeping on the ground, he offered no words. He gazed out over the crowd, at the mourners who were there and were also weeping, and his posture changed. He seemed anxious, affected by the air of grief, but also troubled, as if death was somehow tormenting him as well. I glanced over at his disciples, many of whom looked fearful, probably keeping an eye out for the Jewish leaders. But others were fixated on the teacher, waiting, like they too were wondering why he had come. He asked where we had laid Lazarus, and the men of Bethany said, "Lord, come and see." So we traveled then to the hillside, and once we were in front of the tomb, everyone stood in complete silence, still waiting to hear his excuse. But his eyes seemed only to explore every fraction of the stone, every groove, as if something was familiar to him. And then a tear fell down his cheek. And then another. And within moments, his face was covered. And as if each tear seemed to bring a new revelation, the weight of it dropped him to his knees. And he wept. I had never known the teacher to be so acquainted with sorrow and grief. But there he was. And the crowds began murmuring amongst themselves, many acknowledging how he loved our brother, but others criticizing him. I heard one woman scoff, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" I despised her for her comment, yet I knew that all the rest of us were wondering the same. Why hadn't he kept my brother from dying? The teacher seemed more deeply moved in his spirit now than I'd ever seen him before, and he stood up and approached the cave with the stone pushed against it. An almond tree next to me swayed in the breeze, and as I turned to look at it, I noticed a single blossom gently springing forth, the first of the season. And that's when I heard him say, "Take away the stone." Immediately, everyone's eyes grew wide with shock, and I naturally protested, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." The crowd murmured in agreement and rustled with discomfort and disgust, confused why the teacher would make such an unclean request. Many began retreating back to the village, others began arguing amongst themselves, and their voices grew so loud that he had to shout over top of them, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" He searched the crowd for a response, but nobody knew what he was talking about. He hadn't said anything about seeing the glory of God. He just said that if we believed in him, that we would never die, and that he was the resurrection, but that hadn't really made much sense, so I just sort of pushed it aside, not really understanding. But before I could think any further, he motioned again towards the tomb, and the men of Bethany reluctantly began rolling away the stone. Instantly, the stale stench of the decomposing body effused from the cave, and my insides twisted like a coiled snake. I wanted to run away from it, from the angst, the grief. But then there he stood, unwavering before the open tomb, arms outstretched and looking heavenward. He prayed as if he was somewhere else. "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I know that you always hear me. But I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." And as he said this, his face to the now darkened sky, I felt a drop fall on my forehead. And then another. And within moments, there was a downpour of rain from the heavens, and the sound of each drop hitting the ground echoed into the cave and along the hillside, where we stood in the dust that was now forming mud around our feet. Unable to move, we watched as he took a deep breath. And then he called out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." Nobody said a word. And everyone's eyes were now fixated on the open doorway, as the rain falling created a veil in front, through which a figure slowly began to emerge, covered in stained linen strips. Strips that constrained him, restricted his movement, held him captive. Strips that we had tied him with. But then the teacher commanded with such authority, "Unbind him and let him go." Immediately, the disciples rushed to the figure while others brought clothing, and they stripped him of what layered his once dead flesh, revealing him piece by piece. Mary and I just stood there, hardly breathing, watching but not understanding, looking but not seeing, until we felt the teacher's hands rest on our shoulders, and his very presence seemed to breathe life back into us. We rushed to our brother and embraced him, unsure whether the drops in our cheeks were tears or the rain still falling from the sky. hadn't arrived late. But in his own time. So that he could show us the glory of God. So that he could demonstrate that somehow he is one with God. Who did I believe him to be? Who was this man achieving victory over the grave? Releasing us from grief, taking away the sting of death, bringing resurrection here, bringing the very presence of life itself among us here. He wasn't just showing us the glory of God among us. He is God among us. He is the resurrection and the life.